At some point in your life, you probably knew someone who worked for 30 or 40 years for the same company. There used to be lots of those stories, along the lines of, my father worked here, my grandfather worked here, my son works here. Those stories are less common today. It's unlikely for someone to get a family wage job out of high school and be able to stay there until retirement. That change in society is followed in the new book, The End of Loyalty, The Rise and Fall of Good Jobs in America. It's the work of Rick Wortsman, who spent two decades as a reporter, editor, and columnist for The Wall Street Journal and The Los Angeles Times. Since then, he's written several books and a number of columns on work for Fortune Online. Rick is currently the director of the K.H. Moon Center for a Functioning Society at the Drucker Institute, a part of Claremont Graduate University. Rick Wortsman, thanks for joining us.
Hey, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So you're the second guest in a few months. Mark Levinson was the other to talk about today's economy in the context of World War II and the post-war boom. Do you think, as he does, that the good old days were something of an exception in American economical life?
It's a great question, and I do, for lots of reasons. The biggest one may be that in the wake of the war, we had bombed our competition, our global competition, if not out of existence, to its knees, and American companies could certainly afford to be incredibly generous to their workers at that time. Big American companies were sort of the only game, I guess not in town, but across the globe. And you also had at that time the emergence of really the great American middle class, with all the returning servicemen, tens of millions of folks who came back from the war, and it was the baby boom and the beginning of suburban America in many ways, the kind of big onset of jet travel, of automobiles becoming even more common than they had been, televisions, refrigerators. You know, it was the emergence of the great consumer class, which fueled this great rise.
So the numbers are faintly shocking in terms of raises in the last 40 years versus the previous 25. I knew that wages had stagnated for a long time, but I didn't realize how serious this is.
It really is, and it explains a lot of the anxiety and the anger that we have seen certainly expressed during the last election. And I would say, both in terms of Donald Trump's victory and in terms of Bernie Sanders, who, his message, which resonated with a lot of people, I think he won 22 states, coming from the other political direction. So you see it there. And you're right. And the numbers basically you can think of this way. So I actually tend to think of compensation, so both wages and benefits. For the typical workers, this covers about 80% of workers in America, you would have seen after World War II to the early 70s, about a 90% increase in real wages and benefits, and since then it's been about 10% over that time. So just, you hear about wage stagnation, that's it.
Wow, so 90% growth in wages and benefits over 25 years, and then in the following 40, 10%.
That's right.
Wow. Okay, so if we're thinking, though, that, times must be tough for corporations, what's the truth there?
Well, they certainly haven't been terribly tough of late. Corporations have earned record profits in recent years. American companies are, by and large, doing quite well. So then the question really becomes, what's happened? Why aren't they distributing the gains as they once were? Or to look at it another way, where's all that money going? And there are a few answers to that, but by and large, it's going to shareholders in one form or another, often in the form of higher dividends and very much in the form of stock buybacks, where companies will repurchase their own shares and in doing so try and raise the value of their stock. And so shareholders have really been placed over and above all other stakeholders, including workers, really over the last 30 years, and that's a huge piece of what I explore in the book.
Well, I was reminded recently too that it is not just the buying and selling of stocks that makes you money, but just holding a stock and getting the dividends paid to you makes you money. So, I mean, that seems to be obscured by how fast shares move around in the market today, but that's still a great value to somebody who owns a bunch of stock in a company that makes some money.
It can be. I mean, not all stocks pay out dividends, and not all pay increasing dividends. But what there really has been is just rising pressure from shareholders including a lot of so-called activist shareholders of late. I think, you know, they used to be called raiders and other things. And they have really put pressure on companies to focus inordinately on short-term financial results and on doing everything they can to cut costs. And that's not good for workers' pay. It's not good for their benefits. It's not good for their job security. And it's not good for investing in your workforce and training them. Even in the late 1970s, the average worker, this is according to Peter Capelli, a great scholar at Wharton at the University of Pennsylvania, workers were still receiving about 2.5 weeks of training a year on average. That's now down to 11 days, and many workers receive no skills training at all. So, again, companies are just not investing in their people the way they used to, even though every executive you talk to will invariably say, oh, our people are our most important asset. But they're not acting like it.
Well, they're all often the most expensive asset, too, aren't they? That when you look at the bottom line of a company and you're looking for places to cut costs, if you're an activist shareholder, for example, I mean, it's the humans that are going to be the largest single cost item, aren't they?
Yes, indeed. And so that's why we have this phenomenon of downsizing, which just seems so relentless.
All right, we'll come back and talk more with Rick Wartzman about his fascinating book called The End of Loyalty, The Rise and Fall of Good Jobs in America. You've already gotten a bit of a bite at the apple about what he sees as the major issue. We'll come back and talk more with him and take phone calls and emails from you when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about the change in relationships between employers and employees in America with Rick Wartzman, who's the author of a new book called The End of Loyalty, The Rise and Fall of Good Jobs in America. We've already established that in the 25 years after World War II, compensation increased 90%. And in the 40 years since, 10%. So yes, wages have indeed stagnated in America. And he explores the reasons why as he looks at four companies in detail. You can join the conversation on the exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So this gets more than just theoretical. You really do get into some detailed case histories of these companies. How did you choose these four, GM, GE, Kodak, and Coca-Cola?
Yeah, so I picked four companies. It's interesting. Originally, I had thought about doing this book and telling this larger story through the lens of one company. And when I was very early on in my research and trying to just conceptualize the narrative, and if you've read it, you see it's all driven by kind of character and scene. I like to tell stories. And I was thinking of actually focusing on Hewlett-Packard. And in the end, my publisher, I think, very wisely convinced me that to tell the story through one company, it's just going to end up being a book about that company. Even though if I would try to focus on larger things, it's still just going to be an HP book in that case. So I began to think, well, how could I tell the story of multiple companies? And I settled on these four because I found just a great piece of history. All four companies were instrumental toward the end of World War II in establishing an organization called the Committee for Economic Development. The CED, as it's known, is still around today. It's now part of the Conference Board, another business organization. But this was kind of a moderate sort of center-left business group with a lot of corporate giants at its core, as you could hear those company names. And they really set out a vision for what post-war America should look like economically and socially, and it involved the establishment of good jobs with security, good pay, good benefits, and so on. And so these four were instrumental in the founding of the CED, and that just became a great jumping-off point to then weave in and out of their stories over this 70-year arc.
So, Rick, were the CED members doing this out of altruism or a search for higher profits, or they wanted to make the world safe for democracy by expanding capitalism, or all the above?
I'd say, you know, all of the above. So there was a real mix of impulses going on. So again, remember the times. We had tens of millions of soldiers and sailors and airmen who were returning from battle, tens of millions of folks. And there was a real fear, first of all, that if not enough good jobs would be created and created by the private sector, that we would end up with breadlines again, maybe a Great Depression, even greater than the Great Depression that had transpired in the 30s. And there was real fear that if that happened, fear among these business leaders, that America might make a hard turn toward socialism or even communism. So there was fear involved. There was also some measure of what you say about wanting to make the economy move. There was a feeling that you, very Keynesian notion then, that you had to put money into people's pockets to fuel this consumer economy that was seen as rising and so important. So, you know, it's the old Henry Ford notion. You raise wages of your workers, in his case, from $1 a day to $5 a day, and lo and behold, they can afford to buy cars.
So, yeah, the cars that Ford makes, yeah, the cars that they make.
So exactly. So there was that going on as well. And then there was also a measure, I guess you could say, you know, paternalism, some would call it, maybe a bit unkindly or critically. But there was, I think, a real ethic that was prevalent in America then, which is really lost today. And that is, having come through the Depression and World War II, people really, including corporate executives, felt like we're kind of all in this together. It was a we society, if you will, not so much an I society. And there was a feeling that you kind of took care of all your stakeholders. You took care of your people. And there was just a different, I think, social norms were different. There was a different culture nationally, and that was reflected in corporate culture.
Rick Wartzman is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book about how things have changed between employers and employees is called The End of Loyalty, The Rise and Fall of Good Jobs in America. Now, that we were just talking about the CED, the Committee for Economic Development, and the four companies you follow had their bosses involved here. Some people thought of the CED as a bunch of radicals. Why?
Well, they were seen as a bunch of radicals because, again, as I said, they were kind of a bit more to the left politically and ideologically. So they called for things like actually working with labor unions, or at least being somewhat accepting of organized labor as an important counterbalance to corporate power, and they saw some good in that. Other kind of hardline business groups, the National Association of Manufacturers, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, were staunchly anti-union. The CED also embraced some Keynesian ideas about needing to put more money into the economy, and so they promoted government spending in some cases, and they were not reflexively for cutting corporate taxes. They wanted a bigger social safety net to some degree. So, you know, it's all relative. They were not radicals by any means, but in business circles, their positions were seen as pushing to the left.
And I understand, too, that some people thought it was unseemly that here they were talking about the post-war landscape in 1943 when nobody really knew when the war was going to end. Now, some of the ideas, though, date back much farther than that, and they come back to the founder of Kodak, George Eastman. I mean, how long had he been doling out some fairly nice bonuses and things like that for his people?
Yeah, so he started very early on, not long after the turn of the century. One of the sort of things that he did was to create something called a wage dividend, which, you know, lasted at Kodak for an incredibly long time, even when it went through its bankruptcy and in recent years. But this idea, I mean, it's almost crazy to think of it in today's terms, given where workers are in the pecking order versus shareholders. But Eastman's idea very explicitly was, if we're going to give a dividend to our shareholders, as we should if we're profitable and we're going to take care of the owners of the company, we also need to give a dividend, what he called a wage dividend, in effect a profit-sharing bonus, to our workers, because he said they're the heart and soul and the hands of the company. They're what makes it go, and it's only fair that they share in these good times. And it was like twice a year, or I guess the payouts varied a little bit depending on the cycle, but every spring in Rochester, where the bulk of Kodak workers were, there would it would be like Christmas. They would get these giant checks for, you know, the equivalent of thousands of dollars in today's terms. And the merchants all over town, the car dealers, the appliance dealers, the clothiers and so on, they'd hold these big bonus day sales for Kodak workers. And a lot of money got turned over then.
And was Kodak ever a target for unionization in those days?
Well, that's the thing. So this is another impulse. So Kodak was a practitioner of what scholars call welfare capitalism, kind of a great term. And, you know, today you hear about corporations receiving
That's not good. I think we just lost Rick Wortsman. So we're going to go
get him back on the line. If we
turn the phone down, there we go. So there, Rick Wortsman is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is The End of Loyalty, The Rise and Fall of Good Jobs in America. And you can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 over the phone. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Rick chose four different companies to profile on this, all of whom were involved in the Committee for Economic Development, making plans for post-war America in 1943. The companies are General Motors, General Electric, Kodak, and Coca-Cola. And we got Rick Wortsman back on the line. Welcome back.
Hey, sorry, I don't know where I did my. I'm in a hotel in New York, and the phone died here, and I apologize.
We have learned. You actually sound a lot better than you did before, but VoIP, the voiceover internet protocol phone systems aren't necessarily the best, so we get the occasional drop call. No problem. So we were talking about welfare capitalism, as it was known, George Eastman, as and the effect of not unionizing as a result.
That's right. So I don't know where I dropped off, but the idea from Eastman very explicitly was he was very anti-labor. And this was also part of why at least some companies treated their workers so well in terms of pay and benefits. They very much wanted to counter-organize labor. And Kodak was never organized. And it did this largely by lavishing such good pay and perks on its people that they managed to say to them, look, you don't need a union to come in and get you these things. We already give you these things, and a union is only going to muck up our relationship.
All right, so that's Kodak. Robert Woodruff and Harrison Jones at Coca-Cola, what was their approach to worker care?
So they had a kind of a bit of a different approach. There were just some fascinating figures. Most of the labor at Coca-Cola then, and you know, writing about from the 1920s onward and in the book and up through today, the labor isn't at corporate headquarters in Atlanta, which is effectively just a big branding and advertising agency. It's not that many people that work there in the scheme of things. It's out at the bottling plant level where, you know, the syrup is turned into soda and bottled and put on those red trucks that we see driving out all over the place and taken to supermarkets or now Walmarts or whatever. And you know, cases and pallets of Coke are loaded and unloaded. And so that is that's where the action has been. There's been some organizing of labor by the Teamsters at Coke over the years, and Coca-Cola itself. Sometimes the parent company, the Coca-Cola Corporation, owns its bottlers outright, and at various times they have sold most of their bottlers. They buy and sell them depending on various corporate strategies of the moment. You know, they're often independent bottlers, and that's where most of the action has been. But there's a lot of fascinating history in the book about Coke's interaction with its bottlers, and Coke is also, I think, a really important part of the book in terms of a lot of the racial history. I write a lot about what happened and some of the changes as people of color and women, too, began to stream into the workforce in the 60s.
Yeah, you're very clear on the fact that that the days that were really good with lavish bonuses and all that were a day when the people who did most of the work were white men. So that has changed a bit, too. I want to get a phone call in here. I've been waiting for a while. Steve and Eugene, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Rick Wortsman, the author of The End of Loyalty.
Buddy, my question is, how much do you attribute the ongoing war against organized labor, the so-called right-to-work states, the firing of the PATCO air traffic controllers, mm-hmm. and so on that has been going on for the last 30, 40 years?
Yep. So it's a great question. So there's sort of two significant markers that you cited there. I think one's really important symbolically, the PATCO strike that you mentioned, where Ronald Reagan fired the striking air traffic control workers. And that was more important symbolically than I think anything, but gave corporations kind of the cover and the impetus to get even tougher with labor. The right to work state move is very significant. It right to work states came about in after the 1947 Taft-Hartley Act, and it took a while for the full effects of that act to kick in, but beginning in the late 50s, much earlier than I imagined, corporations began to push more and more of their factories, companies like General Electric and General Motors, to right-to-work states where it's very hard for unions to organize in the South and in other parts of the country, out of the Northeast, the traditional union strongholds. And the other thing that happened over that beginning, really in the late 50s and accelerating every decade since, is that companies began to take a really hard line against organized labor. They would do everything they could, where once unions were accepted and in some cases even viewed as a good thing in terms of the stability they brought, there really began to be a mindset among corporate executives that unions are a bad thing, and they began to actively do everything they could to keep unions from organizing, things both legal and illegal. And all those trends have accelerated, as well as structural changes to the economy, so that now less than 7% of the private sector workforce in America is unionized. And it's had a huge effect, not only for unionized workers, but across the whole economy.
And what was the figure at one time with unions in the private sector?
It was up to kind of a bit above 30%, maybe around 35% at its height.
All right, so from a third to nearly a third to a 7%, which is a big, big change.
And now a big change, and if I can just say one thing, what the real importance of that change is, when you got up to 25, 30, a little more than 30%, the effect was, again, it wasn't just that workers who carried a union card benefited from collective bargaining and their unions being able to push for higher wages and better benefits for them. But it was a big enough core of workers that there was a tremendous spillover effect. And those are the words that scholars use. They talk about this spillover effect. And so it lifted wages at other companies where workers weren't organized. And it lifted wages and benefits for white-collar workers as well. It was kind of that tipping point around 30%, 25, 30%, where unions really helped across the economy, helped workers have a way to counterbalance corporate power. Now that's lost.
And when you think about it, too, on a societal level, then back in those days, it was much more likely that you knew somebody who belonged to a union, and now it is a lot less likely.
Yes, unless you know a teacher or somebody else in the public sector, right, odds are you do not know somebody who is unionized.
So, you know, you point out that even after the Taft-Hartley Act passed, almost exactly 70 years ago, I noticed that the GM, the General Motors, and the United Auto Workers agreed on the so-called Treaty of Detroit. So there was still some love to be had even after the basic fundamentals changed by law.
That's right. It wouldn't be, as I said, until kind of the late 50s that things really began to shift. But there was this brief period of industrial peace, as it was known, and symbolized, right, most importantly by the Treaty of Detroit, which was the 1950 contract between General Motors and the Walter Reuther-led United Auto Workers, a landmark agreement. And it's a landmark agreement that actually built on some very important things that had been achieved in 1948 in an earlier contract. And it was in 1948 that General Motors introduced a cost of living adjustment into the contract to protect workers against inflation, which, you know, we've had very low inflation for a long time now, but was a huge issue and problem then, and obviously would resurface as a huge problem in the late 60s and into the 70s. That COLA introduction was really, really important. And there was also a provision in there from the labor side where organized labor in that contract recognized the importance of the introduction of technology, of automation, and agreed in essence not to fight it, but would actually be rewarded when there were productivity gains, sometimes labor-enhancing, technology-enhancing productivity gains that came for labor, and labor benefited from those things.
So if the same number of people could make more cars in a day because they were helped by robots, they would get some benefit from that.
That's correct.
All right, much more to talk about with Rick Wortsman. The book is called The End of Loyalty, The Rise and Fall of Good Jobs in America. Back to talk with him about GE, GM, Kodak, and Coca-Cola, and what's happened to the rest of the economy around those four key companies in the last 70 years or so. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Rick Wortsman and your phone calls and emails in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to Rick Wortsman, a longtime columnist, editor, reporter for the Wall Street Journal and the Los Angeles Times, author of several books, now the director of the K.H. Moon Center for a Functioning Society at the Drucker Institute at Claremont Graduate University. He's written a new book called The End of Loyalty, The Rise and Fall of Good Jobs in America, lamenting the days when you could leave high school, get a job, stay there for 40 years, and retire with a living wage. And he points out as well that in the 25 years after World War II, wages for or compensation for the average American went up 90%. In the 40 years since, 10%. So, yes, wages have indeed stagnated in America. The book examines why through General Motors, General Electric, Kodak, and Coca-Cola. Conversation you can join on the exchange, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I want to come back in time just a little bit because we haven't established some of the real, street cred and altruism for some of the major figures in these companies as the 20th century moved on. Gerard Swope, for example, at General Electric had a connection to Jane Addams.
Yeah, it was actually, I was really kind of stunned when I started looking at the history of these companies. And Gerard Swope, who was an early CEO of General Electric, right, had been really a progressive and had, in his early days, worked at Hull House in Chicago, a very kind of immigrant tenement house. Where immigrants often from Europe would settle and be given all kinds of skills training and take classes, and was also a heartbeat of union organizing and of left-wing causes. And Gerard Swope really developed an affinity for working folks and the plight of working folks, particularly in those days when factory work was just so brutal. And went on to MIT and got an engineering degree and ended up at General Electric and rose through the ranks and became CEO, but never forgot kind of where he came from and, what working folks in America were going through. And he set out to be very generous to them as a result.
So one of the overall observations that I was getting from the first part of the book anyway was that the people who were nice to the workers in the early days were people who, if they weren't actually workers themselves, had some expertise other than just I'm a manager of a company.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. Several people who've read the book have mentioned this to me, that there just seemed to be less, and it's true, there was less of a distance between the person on the shop floor and the person in the executive suite, if they even had executive suites way back then. There wasn't that distance. And again, I think this common experience, people had come through the Depression, World War II, there weren't, private jets and gated communities the top executives lived in. They were much more of the community. And I think that, that's definitely a reason that, again, these cultural norms, these social norms, why there was a more generous contract between employer and employee.
And so then we fast forward a few decades from the Gerard Swope days at General Electric to after the war with GE and Lemuel Ricketts Boulware. There's a name. What did he do at GE to make himself so unpopular?
Well, he was simultaneously, I mean, depending on who you talk to, you know, wildly popular or tremendously unpopular, mostly tremendously unpopular with organized labor and ultimately with a lot of workers. Lem Boulware was a really interesting figure, a very important one. I'd say next to the names Taft-Hartley, which pushed labor law, you know, to the right and did much to thwart union organizing. Lem Boulware's name among union organizers raises as much ire and anger among them. He was somebody whose policy was this: we're going to, again, take good care of our workers. We're going to give them good pay. We're going to give them good benefits, the best we can afford anyway, given kind of what our profits are at the moment. We have many stakeholders, and he talked about this multi-stakeholder model. We have shareholders. We have to invest back in the business. We have to take care of our workers. We need to pay taxes to the government. And we have to take care of all these obligations. And we're going to have a very straight-up deal. We're going to tell our workers what we can afford. We're going to show them all our cards, he would say. And we're going to, instead of going through this rigmarole of union negotiations and haggling back and forth, and we come in with an offer we know is too low, and the union comes in with an offer that's too high, like, you know, people bartering at a you know, Middle Eastern bazaar, a flea market, we are going to come in with a very straight up offer, and we're going to present that, and that's the best we can do. And ultimately, this, and we're going to tell our workers about it. We don't need the union to inform them about what we're offering. And he kind of made an end run around the electrical workers union, and would present with all kinds of barrage of propaganda, basically, what GE was offering.
I haven't asked in very specific terms what the Taft-Hartley Act did. I mean, obviously it led to things like the right to work laws, but what were some of the other key provisions of the Taft-Hartley Act in 1947? Again, almost exactly 70 years ago to the day that it was signed into law. But what was it that made a big change, the fundamental change for unions in America?
Right. I think ultimately, you know, was right to work should not be underestimated in terms of, again, making it harder for unions to organize, and in certain parts of the country, and now I think more than half the states have right to work laws on the books, and that accelerated the push by companies like GE, like GM, to relocate factories in areas where unions didn't have a toehold, much less a stronghold, and they could pay their workers a lot less in those places, and they did. And this sort of foreshadowed the moving of you know, the next step, which was actually moving overseas and moving factories overseas where you could find even cheaper labor. And we haven't even talked, we've touched on automation barely, and globalization, another major force. The other interesting thing in the book, I think, that Taft-Hartley did, there was a move back in the 1940s where factory foremen, were trying to organize and unionize. And Taft-Hartley made it illegal for any supervisory workers, factory foremen, to organize.
Oh, made them middle managers, effect. In essence.
Yeah, managers. And it has made it so that to this day, you know, foremen sort of were always the guys caught in the middle, and it was mostly guys. That is, they were managers, and those below them on the front lines of an auto factory, say, often felt like, you know, I've got this jerk of a boss who's sitting on me, and would complain about the foreman. And then the foreman, meanwhile, was getting squeezed from their supervisors, the plant manager, higher up executives, you know, drive the line faster, make more profit. And so they kind of felt caught in the middle, much like middle managers in America, you know, do today.
I wonder, too, Rick, how much the rise of McCarthyism in the years after the Taft-Hartley Act might have contributed to the dim view of unions, and some certainly poor moves by the unions themselves as they began to look more like organized crime as the 50s and 60s wore on.
Yeah, there were certainly some missteps. So first of all, right, particularly the old CIO unions before the merger of the AFL-CIO in the mid-50s, the old CIO unions, some of them were out and out backed by, the Communist Party or affiliated with communists and socialists, and they made no bones about it. And so as the Red Scare took hold in the, you know, 40s and 50s, much as it had in the teens in America, there was definitely some backlash to organized labor there. And you even had figures like Walter Reuther of the auto workers and Jim Carrey of the electrical workers explicitly break away from the communist elements within their own union and go off and either oust them or, in Carrey's case, form a whole different union. So that was part of what was going on. There were missteps, as you say, in the 50s and 60s. There was some corruption and organized crime that got involved with organized labor. Others say that unions over time, they kind of lost their soul, and maybe that was inevitable given that some of the worst abuses that had occurred through, say, the 1930s and into the 40s, they had corrected. They had won big wage gains. They had won big gains on benefits. Some, you know, workplace standards and conditions had gotten better. There were grievance systems set up to handle complaints at the local factory level. And so they had kind of done their job in a sense. And so there was a little less fire for the union movement. They had a little less to fight for, some would say. But mostly, what my research really shows is for all of organized labor's missteps, it was really a concerted effort by corporate America to crush organized labor that has had the biggest effect on organized labor's decline.
And that is a major number, as you point out, 7% of union representation in the private sector now versus about 30% at its peak. Let's talk about things like globalization, though, because the fact is that over time, as the economies of the countries that we had defeated in World War II recovered, particularly Germany and Japan, they started making stuff that was viewed as better than American products, particularly cars and electronics. That was going to make an impact on what workers made here, because if people weren't buying the stuff the workers were making, that was going to make a difference.
Absolutely. So if you know, the arc of the book is such, it really traces through these four companies kind of America's economic history. And what you see is we went from being on top of the world in the 1950s and through much of the 60s. And by the late 60s into the early 70s, some real weaknesses were being exposed. And, I'll invoke Peter Drucker here, the namesake of the institute where I worked. I remember talking to an executive once, and he said, Peter Drucker once asked me, what's the worst thing that can happen to a company? And the guy gave him a bunch of kind of mumbling answers, and Drucker said, no, the worst thing that can happen to a company is success. And I think that's what happened here. These companies were so incredibly successful. They got, frankly, a little bit fat and lazy, and they stopped investing in the way they had through the 40s and 50s. And you can look at the numbers. There's a lot of numbers around this. And particularly in R&D and other innovations. And our global competitors, Japan, Germany, others, began to leapfrog past us in terms of technological capability and quality.
Particularly R&D, and this one comes out to me because I don't know if you included Bell Labs in the book. I remember reading that they were not really expected to develop things that AT&T could use, but they were just supposed to be smart and develop cool things.
That's right. Yeah, and there's just, you know, over time, right, we've seen a big decline in that kind of basic research, from corporations, for sure. Again, it goes back to, where do you want to put your money? What do you want to invest in? Is it all about shareholders, or is it about a balance of interests?
Well, and I wonder about the emphasis on shareholders over time. I mean, because as we look back to some of the major figures in the creation of GM, GE, Kodak, and Coca-Cola, these were people who at least might have invented something or might have worked at the actual jobs that they were hiring people for later on. Does anybody from the manager class today have that kind of background?
That's a really interesting question. And there's a great book called The Puritan Gift, by two brothers named Hopper, and they wrote about in great detail about just what you're saying, that it used to be that managers had what they called domain knowledge, right? You know, they'd really know, a rising steel executive would know a lot about metallurgy or actually making steel. And today it's sort of much more common where you have MBAs who feel like they can just go manage anything and they don't actually need a lot of specific domain knowledge about the industry they're in, and that there's been some real costs to that.
So you mentioned in the preface of the book that you don't think any prodding from Washington can change the situation. It's certainly not going to come back to the days when we see the kinds of gains in earnings that workers made back in the day. But so what would change? I mean, do corporate leaders think they should change?
Well, look, I don't, as I said, and your first question was that a unique time? Was that a kind of historical blip, this post-war golden age, if you will, of rising pay and benefits for the broad swath of the American workforce? And I think in many ways it was an anomaly because of the unique circumstances in which the country found itself that we talked about. But I do think that if we can't push fully back to where we were, we can at least begin to push back in that direction. And that will take a combination of things. I do think there's a lot that Washington can and should do. I think the earned income tax credit needs to be raised. I think the minimum wage needs to be raised. I think that there needs to be a whole rethinking of government training. But ultimately, it's really going to be up to corporate leaders to decide it is their responsibility to take care of their people and not just do it with lip service, but to really do it.
Well, it's a gripping yarn, and I'll tell you, you learn a lot about, you get a real sharp focus on how we got to where we are today. The book is called The End of Loyalty, The Rise and Fall of Good Jobs in America. Rick Wortsman wrote it and joined us today in The Exchange. Rick, thank you.
Hey, thanks so much, Jeffrey.